And so we want to preserve that, and we focus on that. So Mazzoo as a content messaging platform has no view counters and no followers. Those are the two most ridiculous things, as far as I'm concerned, in social media. They're the most addictive functions in a negative reinforcement environment, in B.F. Skinner's world, in Pavlov's dog on steroids. It's actually nonsensical, because we all know how those experiments ended up, and they weren't in a good way. So for kids, they don't need to have that environment right away. They actually don't need to be conditioned that way. When you focus on a sense of purpose, which means all the content speaks to the values of a child and their character.
That was today's guest, Janice Taylor. Janice is the CEO of the social network Mazzoo. Mazzoo is a platform with the mission to provide a safe, fun environment for children to learn how to navigate the online social media landscape. In this episode, Janice is going to talk to us about the importance of social media as a platform to help family units, how designers can move beyond optimizing for dopamine stimulation, and ultimately how we can engineer a sense of purpose for both children and adults alike. We've got a lot to get through this week, so I hope you enjoy listening to Janice Taylor. Janice, welcome to Digital Mindfulness. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show at last, because we've been trying to make this happen for a long time now. And I'm really excited to be learning more about you and this fantastic company you've created. So welcome.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm glad we could finally connect.
So let's start, Janice, by introducing yourself to the audience, some of whom might not know much about you or about how you came to create Mazzoo Family and exactly what that's all about.
Well, yeah, for sure. A little bit of my background. So I'm Canadian. I'm actually from one of the provinces that nobody ever hears about, except when they hear it, they're like, that's a name, which is Saskatchewan. So which is in the middle of Canada, and it's sort of the frozen tundra. So I was raised there by a single mom and really had a village of families from all over the world that really raised me as my mom worked. My roots are English, though. My grandmother was from England. And I really was a child of the village, and my education was psychology, and my business acumen at the time was real estate investing. And about 2009, I noticed this really sort of sharp change in the physical neighborhoods. I was like, where did everyone go? And in Canada, you know, there was no hockey nets in the driveway and kids weren't in the playground. And that really wasn't typically Canadian and really very much not Saskatchewan. So I was just sort of struck by the quiet outside. And as I was walking my kids to school and I got closer to the school, I noticed that parents didn't get out of the car and everyone was on their phone. And it just struck me again. I was like, what's going on here? If we don't know each other within our physical neighborhoods, and if we don't know each other's kids that are playing with other kids, we can't raise kids as a village. That's initially what I thought. And I thought, what happened? So I went home, and I was, again, a single mom like my mom, and I Googled, of all things, how to make a tech company. And I was instantly thought that this problem had been created in technology that was creating this very, very quiet, isolated environment in real life. And I thought, oh my gosh, I got to do something about this. And everybody thought I was totally crazy. And of course, I didn't know how to make a tech company. I didn't know anybody making a tech company. But I figured that if technology caused the problem, I could use technology to solve it. So I quit my job and joined this crazy startup life. So that's really what happened. And at the same time, a friend of mine said, you should check out this thing called Facebook. Now, in 2009, being from Saskatchewan in Canada, we were three years later than the rest of the world. That's kind of how we always trended on things. And so we were late to the party, and I opened it up, and I instantly felt eerie. And I thought, oh my, this is Pavlov's dog on steroids. Like, we are going to hyper-condition people to the negative. That's how I knew from doing a psych degree, and I did my thesis on women and self-esteem, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, the worst that this is going to happen is going to be for women, families, and children. That's what I thought right away. And I thought, well, again, this is a mess. So that's how I started in technology.
You know, Janice, we speak to a lot of different founders on the show, and there's always a very important inflection point at which they start to become more interested and start to do things in this space. And to me, it sounds like it very much is when you became a mother, when your children came along, that you started to think about the quality of how you interact online and of your digital experiences.
It really did. You know, it smacked me in the forehead and really sent a chill down my spine, because, you know, part of my life was spent around the addiction community as well. So my very first sort of introduction to that was my father was a chronic alcoholic. And so I was very attuned to that world, to AA, to Al-Anon. And I really looked at it very differently immediately. I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be a perfect storm. And eventually I knew everybody would be in love with it, like the new drug. But I also knew after spending so much time with addicts is that eventually it implodes. It stops being useful. And so I was more fascinated by what happens after this mess and what are we going to do about it? And so quitting my job was scary, but then I wrote to Oprah Winfrey and I said, this is my story. I'm a poor kid from Saskatchewan, Canada. I'm going to make a tech company to solve the mess that's going to come in about a decade. That's kind of what I said to her. And 3 days later, I had a call from the Oprah show. And so that's how I got plucked out of Saskatchewan off to the Oprah show. And then I ultimately ended up living in Silicon Valley for a time before coming back to Canada.
That's a really great story. And I'm particularly fascinated by your academic background in psychology, particularly because when talking about our digital experiences in the literature and also speaking to some experts, they would say that it's difficult to use the phrase addiction when talking about digital experiences. But would you say that there are some parallels between the two?
100%. I think that sometimes the theory of addiction gets lost in substances that we ingest. So is there a chemical, physical, measurable response to addiction? So that's where the addiction terminology kind of seems to go into sort of this gap. From my perspective, addiction is really any time that we are numbing and stuffing our feelings and not being present in our life. So the true form, and there's a fascinating psychologist based here in Canada who's also a medical doctor, a psychiatrist. He's sort of leading the world now on the topic of addiction, and he works in Vancouver, British Columbia's east side. And we talk about, you know, this numbing and stuffing of addiction, and that really addiction is about trauma. It's about things that happened and transpired in your childhood, probably before your 10th birthday. And as we get older, we get activated in that old wound and that old pain. And when we get activated in it, we seek substances, humans, technology, food, work, anything that really numbs us and stuffs us and takes us away from where we presently live. And so that's the addiction, that definition of addiction is the one that we adopt here at Mazu and that I look at in the world of technology. So in my mind, this is the most rapid amount of disconnect and numbing and stuffing of our times, which by that definition, I would say the most addicted we've ever become.
You know, Janice, I'm really interested in your approach to solving this problem as you saw it, because your concern was peaked when you kind of became more aware of how people were becoming addicted to their digital experiences. But you chose more to focus on improving people's experiences with digital rather than finding a simple engineering solution to make products more addictive, but perhaps less negative.
Yeah, you know, and there's so much theory to this. We could probably talk all day because I spent about the last decade looking at all different theories, from the theory of motivation to what makes people motivated to how do you actually go on a diet, for example, what's the barriers, kind of looking at abundance and scarcity theory. Anything and any time you tell someone to stop doing something, there's an immediate visceral response to it, like, hell no, you know, you've got to do this. Dread comes into your being when you say you will never see a French fry again. And you're like, what? And what's fascinating to me, with a large portion of the addiction community I now work with, I work primarily with women, And I've created a completely different approach called Ahava, which actually has its roots more in abundance theory versus scarcity. And so when we think about scarcity right away with addiction, there's this whole abstinence, right? The 12 steps, like you must never drink again. That's what they say to you. And what we do really is we put ourselves into this codependent cycle where we're like, oh my God, you know, alcohol was so amazing for me at one point, but now it's gone forever. And we stay in this longing for it. And the way that I looked at technology, I thought, well, is there a healthier approach? And if we look at technology as what I would say a stepwise or a dryout period, we need to progressively move ourselves away from the hyper dependence we're currently experiencing. And so I looked at it more like an intermediary and said, you know, between where we are right now, which I call the vortex, to ultimate living present with our life in a time period where we don't have technology, is there a space in between? And when you work with addicts, they'll talk about times where they go into detox, then they slowly integrate themselves back into the environment. And how do we function in that environment with a healthy relationship with that we have been numbing and stuffing with? So that's how I looked at the world of technology and have spent the last decade of my life studying what that intermediary looks like in technology.
So then, Janice, you spent the last 10 years of your life building up this organization called Mazu. And I wonder if you can just tell us what that is exactly and why it's so important.
Yeah, so just as a functionality, as a vehicle, I say. So Mazu would function, it's an app, it's a content messaging platform. The two things that exist, say, in Instagram, there's content and there's messaging. But then that's when we spew and we sort of skew off. So when we talk about addiction and when we talk about trauma, it generally happens before a child's 10th birthday. So I immediately knew that I would focus on an age group under the age of 13. And we focus on early child prevention and early conditioning. And so when we look at conditioning, which is what happens currently in, say, Instagram and Facebook, is that behavior conditioning will skew to the negative. It will skew to your mastery and autonomy, ringing the bell. The third type of motivation is a sense of purpose. And in children, they take in content and are inspired by others. Their sense of purpose is actually the most alive. By the time we hit 20, the life has beat the crap out of us and we said, oh, I no longer have a purpose. But kids actually really genuinely come into the world believing they have one. And so we want to preserve that and we focus on that. So Mazu as a content messaging platform has no view counters and no followers. Those are the two most ridiculous things, as far as I'm concerned, in social media. They're the most addictive functions in a negative reinforcement environment, in B.F. Skinner's world, in Pavlov's dog on steroids. It's actually nonsensical, because we all know how those experiments ended up, and they weren't in a good way. So for kids, they don't need to have that environment right away. They actually don't need to be conditioned that way. When you focus on a sense of purpose, which means all the content speaks to the values of a child and their character. Now, the other major component of Mazu is we don't isolate children from their parents or their family. That's the most important thing that has happened in technology. We have created isolated spaces where children are off in one world and parents are off in their world. And that actually is a disservice to children, because the most important person in the world to kids is mom and dad and grandma and grandpa and aunt and uncle. They want to see you. You're the star of their life. They actually don't want to talk to strangers in the internet. But right now they're going to spaces and they have no choice. And that's changing how they see themselves. The other most important component of Mazu is we filter all of the content and all of the language. This whole notion of resiliency with kids no longer applies in the world of technology. Because the world of technology, particularly social media, children are bombarded daily with all the reasons of why, of everything that is telling them that who they are is not good enough. They do not need that reinforcement when they are developing the emotional part of their brains. So we protect that. So Mazu is the Disney movie for the family in social media. It is the creative interactive space of Sesame Street. It pulls in a little Mr. Rogers and says, yes, you are beautiful and you are awesome and we're going to protect you in the world. And it's important that that space exists, because right now what we have in the vortex is no alternative. So we don't see ourselves as a replacement to Instagram or to Facebook. We are saying to families, if you have children under the age of 13, bring yourself and your children to Mazoo and nurture them here before they enter the wild, wild west. They need swimming lessons. They need dry out periods from the nonsense and the conditioning that they're currently experiencing. And we need a healthy alternative.
I think this is incredibly interesting because if you think of the time that we spend online and when we do enter into these different services and apps, they really are spaces in much the same way as parks or different buildings or schools. They really are spaces, and we wouldn't let children go into physical spaces unsupervised. But when young people do go into digital spaces, we do let them go on without supervision. And I think listening to what you've just described, it does seem a bit nonsensical that we would allow the latter for the digital spaces, but we certainly wouldn't even countenance letting our children go to physical spaces unsupervised.
I think what's the most fascinating thing about the last decade, and there's a really interesting book called Where Great Ideas Come From, and it's by Stephen Johnson, and he really talks about these 10-year blocks of time. Now, in his book, he says, oh, well, with the advent of technology, that no longer applies. And I would say with the usage, like the utility of something, we can pick up something in days and months, and that becomes a new way of doing things. But psychologically, what he missed in his book, psychologically and emotionally, we actually move in our lives in 10-year blocks. You know, if you kind of look at birth to 10 and 10 to 20 and the 20 to 30s, if you kind of look at it from a psychological point of view, we've watched over the last 10 years, me specifically, because I've been diving into this in the deep end of the ocean to analyze not only the engineering, the psychology, the philosophy, the history, the capitalism, the Marxism, everything about it. Is the thing that's most fascinating to me is we're now experiencing this implosion happening after 10 years being immersed in this system. And I think for most of us, we were sort of all taken away in the tsunami of this. It was suddenly amazing to have a celebrity to retweet your response on Twitter. And you were like, oh my God, they know me, which they don't, but it still felt amazing for about 5 seconds. And we all kind of got lost, but what we also got lost in is this all-for-one solution. Like, everyone should be on Instagram. Well, really, is that true? You know, is Instagram great for influencers that have a product to sell? Probably. Is it really a place to nurture my children in digital? Not a chance. You know, so if we started to think about our lives like we do in real life, you don't go to the same restaurant every day. You don't invite every single person to your house for dinner. You have segments in your life where you do specific things. Now, the way that I see the next version of social media is we need to get back to this relationship to how we live our lives in real life to where we spend our time online. And that needs to be consistent with your values, with who you are as a human, what you stand for, and where you ultimately spend your time. And very much like we already do that in real life. But social media took all of us, and we all kind of went there, and I mean all. We all thought this was the best place to promote your business, to sell something, to invite someone to something, and to spew nonsense. And I think for children, what happened at the bottom of that hill is they got lost in the wild, wild west. That what you were saying at the beginning of this, you would never leave a 5-year-old alone in the shopping mall and leave for 3 hours. You would never. You would, as a parent, have a catastrophic experience to that. And so that's why I always come back to swimming. You would never throw your kids in the deep end of the ocean and drive back to shore. You just would never do that. And in fact, when you were around water, the very first thing that every parent does is they give their kids swimming lessons. It's the very first thing. Kids are in the pool before they walk. And most parents do that because we want our kids to be comfortable with the water. We want our kids to be able to swim and float. We want to teach them the ability to at least tread water. And for some reason, the psychosis of all of this has not created that connection to our real life. And so Mazoo is about really making that real life connection again.
It's really interesting, Janice, that you talk about Stephen Johnson's book, Where Good Ideas Come From, and in particular, not only the 10-year blocks that he speaks about, but also the network effects. Because I'm fascinated that even though you identified these problems with children or young people and their digital experiences, that the way you chose to meet this challenge was by building a social network, when you actually are in that vein then going up against very, very powerful companies and huge communities. So I wonder if you can just talk to us a bit about some of the challenges that you faced in, I guess, reaching your vision with Mazu, because there are enormous social networks who have a lot of resources. So yeah, what challenges did you face and how did you surmount them?
Well, you're 100% right. This has been when I figured I would make a tech company, I figured it's like, okay, you know, I'll build the box and away we go and bada bing, bada bang, and I'll sell some products and away, you know, I had this totally naive experience about it. I had just no idea of the complexity. I'm a social theorist. I study everything from religion to philosophy and psychology and everything in between. But then you layer it into UX design, UI, and engineering and architecture, and where the data and privacy, and how am I going to monetize this thing? So it's like this crazy thing. So to answer the first one around Skinner's box, so Skinner's is what we call the lowest common denominator of behavior change. It's we all know that in psychology, when you talk about B.F. Skinner and behavior conditioning, it's very, very short-lived. That's why that after behavior psychology became the advent of cognitive, and then after cognitive became humanistic, and now there's a new field of psychology called transpersonal. So there's an evolution to the psychology of the humans. But in engineering, the easiest, fastest, quickest way was to use B.F. Skinner's approach to, so that's the lowest form of addiction, and also the lowest form of like how quick and easy it is to do. But it's short-lived, so you're really going over the short term for that. So when you're first designing a product, of course it's easier to add a like button, a view counter, a tag here, a push notification. Those are all elements that create pervasive unconsciousness. So in the experiment, one of the things that's most fascinating to me and why I'm kind of surprised the humans of the world aren't more alarmed by this is really what B.F. Skinner and particularly Pavlov discovered in the behavior conditioning is that they could eliminate some of the basic instincts that us as human beings are born with. And so he used dogs, but he translated the theory to humans. And so what was most fascinating about the theory is that the dog wouldn't eat unless he received the bell. And why this is so alarming to me in the design is that we then end up missing the basic things in our life around our instincts, like love, like humans, like connection, because the bell is far more alluring than food itself. And so when we were designing this, we had to look at the theory of motivation. And so there's a really interesting book by Daniel Pink called Drive, and he talks about the three levels of motivation. And so mastery and autonomy is what we see mostly in any game development, but also in any kind of social network. So can I do this by myself and can I master this by myself? So mastery and autonomy, we know, are the lowest forms of motivation. The third type of motivation that isn't used enough in technology and can be if you're mindful with creating the technology is a sense of purpose. If what I am doing right now, does this give me a validated sense of purpose within myself? It is a proven level of motivation. It is the third type that is not exercised in very, very few places. So us as a team, with an engineering team and my UX and UI designers, every single time they present the next roadmap, which we build in product in every 2 weeks, I always say, does this give me a greater sense of purpose? Do we feel that what we are doing, the exercise of that, gives me a sense of purpose? Then the second part of the network effect. So this is why we include parents. So when we're looking at designing a technology, people will build something that's specific for a kid, and they will look at mastery and autonomy, and they rarely look at a sense of purpose. But children don't have a network yet. They don't. And so if you want to create a social network, you need people that have a network. And so we primarily focus and speak to parents. Parents have a network. And if you think about your family, it's probably 10, maybe 15 people deep, and then that's how you can build a network effect. And I think the third part of this is to go back to some sense of niche communities. You know, I think in the early advent of these communities and why chat rooms were great and why so many people felt connected is because you finally could meet someone like you. There was this affiliation and this assimilation to be like, oh my God, there's someone else in the world that is like me. And where we really kind of got off sidetrack and sideways is the moment that we realized that we could addict people very quickly using Pavlov's dog's theory and B.F. Skinner behavior conditioning. And I'm just going to feed you ads because you're so unconscious, you're not noticing anyway. But again, in a 10-year cycle of the human evolution, we begin to seek alternatives because we realize we're actually empty. We've never ate the food. We've been fooled. We've been duped. And as soon as that starts happening, which is happening right now, and thank God to Britain for ringing a bells and ringing bells and ringing bells before I think even North America did, is we need to be very mindful with how you engineer it. And there's so many other layers to a human psychology if you're mindful enough to actually tap into it. And then the fourth thing I'll just add to that without spewing so much of this is this whole notion of dopamine. So everyone's talking about dopamine. But the brain actually produces a ton of other chemicals that are still highly addictive and highly awesome. And so there's so many that actually have good feeling abilities, that actually when hormones are released, they feel warm and there's loving hormones. But if you actually look at how technology is built, it is primarily, most of the social media platforms as well, were built by 20-something-year-old boys. Well, what do they want? Give it to me now, instantly, right now. And so that's actually only tapping into one portion of their brain, and there's so much more to the brain that you can tap into that can equally be as satisfying and still have the network effect and still build a network.
I think more and more, Janice, people are becoming aware of the stimulation of our dopamine receptors when we start to use digital experiences, and this is something very much that's being complained about. But I'm wondering then, in your vision of creating this social network that doesn't take advantage of these frameworks by Skinner and Pavlov, what then do you use? What are the main mechanisms by which you seek to, I guess, increase engagement or to increase usage of the site?
Yeah, you know, there's a really interesting book that people would go, how are you even, why did you read that book for this? It's something called The Love Language. Have you heard of the book The Love Languages?
I have, yes.
It's how people experience love, anyway. And everybody sort of experiences love differently. But the love drug, the love hormone in the body, is called oxytocin. Are you familiar with oxytocin?
Yes, I do know.
Okay, so it is the, and so, and most people know it with lactating mothers, right? So when women are lactating and they're feeding, and other women are witnessing it as well, there's an immediate hormonal rise in oxytocin. And when we are mothering and gathering, oxytocin levels actually increase. That's why it's called the love drug. It head to toe washes you over with love. And so what we try to do within Mazoo is create experiences that have nostalgia. So how do I take me back to, if I'm a parent, I may have experienced wounds as a child myself, which when you have children, those become more activated. So I'm like, how do I calm that activation that when I'm in Facebook, for example, I feel worse about myself as a parent. I'm comparing my life to everyone else, and all I'm doing is behavior conditioning. In our experience, we want parents to know that we're all in it together. So there's an instant feeling of we are together. How do we be on the same team? The second component of that is how do I tap into the nostalgia of me also being a child but witnessing my child? So that actually produces higher levels of oxytocin amongst mothers, which also has a spillover effect into dads. And then for children, when they are surrounded by love, they feel that they can take on the world. There's a feeling and a sense of purpose that taps into it. So one of the most understudied hormones in many cases has been oxytocin and the actual residual health benefits of it. There was a nurses trial at UCLA, a nurses trial that took two groups of women that had breast cancer, some that had it, and they went into groups, and the other group went by themselves and they went home. The ones that stayed in group had a higher survival rate and a faster cure rate. And so the fascinating thing to me when we're looking at technology is to first look at the chemicals of the brain that actually produce the most positive results. So when we exercise, we release certain endorphins that make us feel amazing. So there's a lot of hormones in the brain that are awesome. For us specifically at Mazzu, we focus on oxytocin. So how do I create an environment that produces and elevates your level of oxytocin so that when you go out back into the world and you're not in our system, that still exists for you? And so what we have right now in the world of social media is we have a ton of fight and flight responses. I'm either fighting with everyone or I'm flying away from everything because I'm so activated in these spaces, not only chemically, and then you throw in dopamine and I'm supposed to be fooled that I'm supposed to feel amazing. But it's so short-lived and the half-life doesn't really go anywhere, and I still leave this environment super, super activated. And so I encourage anybody that's going to decide to go into the world of technology and you're going to design something is to look at the other types of motivation and which they exist. And then the other portion of that is to look at the actual chemicals of the brain.
I think that is absolutely fascinating. So you're encouraging designers to create then not for dopamine or not just for dopamine and not just for fight or flight receptors, but also to stimulate the oxytocin centers for that sense of purpose.
Yes, 100%. So love is the greatest fuel in the world. And so the most fascinating thing in the, well, there's been so many fascinating things. If you look at right now the world of technology and tech startup, there's a lot of discussion about women in tech, for example. But in North America, around 2% of all tech funding goes towards women. Now, there's lots of reasons why that exists, but what it really tells me is that a big portion of what gets made in the world, technology-wise, comes from the portion of the brain that's heavy logic. When you look at women founders look at things very differently. And there's the famous sort of analogy that when men are thinking about something, they pull out their specific boxes in their brain, and that's the box they operate from. When you look at a woman's brain, her brain is a ball of yarn. You don't know where it ends and starts, but she has strung together a whole bunch of threads. And if there's anybody that is in the world thinking about it this way, that's kind of how the brains are. And not in all cases. So it's I'm not saying that all are like that. But what's fascinating to me is that when we look at the inventions, many of the inventions that we are currently seeing are very, very logic utility based. And they're missing the whole love emotional side of their brain. And so instead of me, I always, you know, look at it from a perspective of like, what's really at the root cause of this or what really do we look at? So right now the world is shocked and angry with Mark Zuckerberg about this, that, and the other, and wondering why he doesn't emotionally respond to things normally, and why isn't he doing all these things? And I don't know if that debate's going on your side of the pond, but it's certainly happening on our side of the pond. And from a psychology point of view, one of the most interesting aspects of anybody that's on the spectrum, and I don't know if Mark Zuckerberg's on the spectrum, but I'm just going to say that if on the spectrum, it's called mind blindness. And mind blindness actually exists in a portion of the brain where your empathy is. Now, it's not to say they don't experience empathy. It's just not connected in the same way. So when I look at the world of technology and what's happened in the world of social media, I'm like, of course it's devoid of empathy. It's not engineered to produce empathy. It's just not engineered for that. Because if you look at the creator and you look at the founder and you look at the, where they're coming from, they're making something from the portion of their brain that they ultimately feel is the right way to make it. And the confusion happens is when we psychologically and emotionally can't actually define it, if that makes any sense. I don't know if that made any sense whatsoever, but that's kind of what I'm trying to say is that if more women made more technology companies and more men operated again, and moved into more of the emotional spaces of their brain. And if we start to make things more from the right side of our brain versus the left side of our brain, we're going to see a whole new evolution of technology.
Platforms such as yours, Janice, are doing a really good job of bringing digital well-being to a large number of people, particularly with this emphasis on oxytocin and on connection and on empathy. So I'm wondering for other people that are thinking of starting technology companies or building something, what challenges do they face, or what advice would you give to them?
I think the greatest challenge that we're facing right now in our time period is, again, this sort of disconnect from the products that we're making that we don't think we still need as we grow older. So the human will always require love, no matter what. We still require real-life connection and community. We still want to belong. So you could be 75 years old and still have a longing in your heart to belong to someone or to something. That never goes away. And so all the Fitbits and time well spent on your phone, tracking your time, is all well and good. But the root in every human experience, and I have met very few humans that don't have a certain amount of a break in their spirit, a certain amount where they don't feel quite like they are where they're supposed to be or where they're supposed to belong, or, you know, that they're in the right place. Like, they just are always living looking for something else. And what's so attractive about the world of technology is there's always the latest widget gadget to do something that will actually save me from myself. Like, ultimately, that's what we're looking for. That's why we do meditation. That's why the self-help industry is a trillion-dollar industry, right? Because we're all looking for something to save us from ourselves. And I think the mindfulness and why this movement that you created is so important is that digital mindfulness is to look at the human experience as it is, not in this some advanced form of, like, we're so much different than we were a decade or 20 years ago. But to look at products and technology that can further unite our humanity. And I think the thing that I have found most sad about this last 10 years is how polarized and divided we've become, yet we've never been more informed about something that's going on the other side of the world. And so one of the dangers when you read about capitalism, for example, they say one of the dangers and the only way to ultimately save capitalism as a system is to actually create unity. And so if you're looking to make money, and you look at the theory of even Marxist, and whether you agree or disagree, but if you look at other economic theories, they all point to this really interesting theme in the world's economy of unity. And as long as we are all trying to steal from everybody else's bucket and everybody else's pie and live someone else's life and wanting to be like someone else beside ourselves, what we'll have is this constant running and chasing our tail and pillaging from one to steal to get to another. And we all kind of run around and do that. And in the history of civilizations over, you know, the 2000 time period, the greatest time period is one in which we can live an experience of unity. So whether you're in the UK or you're in Asia, whether you're in Canada or you're in the United States, wherever you are in the world, right now what we have is rapid polarization and rapid globalization. And that has a spillover into the environment. It has a spillover into the economy, into everything that we care about. And at the root cause of all of that is a human being that is striving and looking to feel and love and to know that who they are is pretty awesome, just as they are. And if we can get comfortable there, everything else we want to do in the world is possible. Everything else in the world is possible. You can clear the oceans of plastic if you can unite your fellow group. But as long as we're trying to be better than someone else and it's this whole sort of polarized environment, we will always struggle as a civilization, as far as I'm concerned.
I think the work that you're doing and everything that you've just mentioned, Janice, it's really brought home to me actually just how important social media is. I think that in general, we are so ready to rail against social media companies, but actually the technology just does way more than connecting people or looking at what other people are up to. That actually it does a really excellent job, or it has the potential to do a really excellent job at connecting people with themselves, at generating that empathy for themselves, within themselves. And so its role is really important.
It's so important. It because, you know, it's so aspirational. You know, I think the thing that it taps into all of our desire to be loved and to be seen and to be noticed. And And that's really what social media is. Look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. Will someone please, for the love of Mary and Joseph, look at me. Listen to me, listen to me, listen to me, listen to me. That, you know, if you just really think about it, it's like a whole schoolyard of kids that just opened up their backpack and just drew the most amazing thing at art class. And so the way that I look at it is like that. Now, the problem with it is the fact that we didn't have any respectful boundaries of what that meant, and we don't really acknowledge the other child and someone else. And so when we're saying the things that we do, or whatever's spewing out of our mouth and our activated chihuahuas inside, where we think we can just chew someone out just because we're not going to see them again, that there's a person on the other side of that who is a wounded little child as well, who's just taking in more food of a thing that they already feel about themselves. So they already feel unworthy. Why do you think they're there? And so then we chew them out for having an opinion that's different than our own. And then we want everyone to believe how we believe because it validates our belief structure. And so social media as it's built is, for me, the greatest power of a mirror. To mirror back to us the longing that we all as a human race have. And I think that the illusion of social media is also why it's this constant get, right? We always assume that when we're there, we're suddenly going to arrive and the pain that we feel inside will cease to exist. Now, where I end up being a very vocal, I would say, opponent to the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world is they're not there to solve your problem. They don't give a shit. You know, they're not there to solve that. They're there to make money, and they're making tons of money as you waste your time there. So whenever somebody says how they use social media to me, I say, pull, don't plant. You know, those that planted their entire lives inside the world in the vortex of Facebook, you know, now you're really going to pay for it because now they're just up in the ante all the time. That's not a capitalist system when someone else owns your life. It's pervasive codependency. And at the same time, if you expect him to suddenly change, that's also foolish. The only power that you have is to leave and to begin again and to pull and don't plant. Because the reality of that system is it's just not built for humans.
And I guess if the task of changing the world is too great for other people, then having a sandbox or having a safe space where children can go and connect with one another and learn what it is to network with each other online, then that's incredibly important.
That it's a pure version of what a social network was supposed to be. See, what it was originally was supposed to be was to connect with your family and friends and share photos. You know, that's originally what it was supposed to be, right? And then it became this gross polarization of the worst version of ourselves. So we created a pure version of what we believe social media is for children and families because we owe it to them. We owe it to children to give them an experience. If we're all choosing that digital is not going away, which we've all agreed that it's not, then we need to at least be mindful of where children are and spending their time. My children aren't a product. So if we talk about the monetization, is if we think about the world of social media, humans are the products, which really is just the data points. There's a really interesting book out by Roger McNamee called Zucked. He talks a lot about that in the book. Is the data points that we are feeding to the system to get something for free is nonsensical to me, because in the old days, if you wanted to buy something, you bought something. And you would make a decision whether you would buy this product or that product. And if I was going to go down to the corner store and buy soup, I'd either buy Lipton's or Campbell's, and I got to choose which one. And at that time period, you would decide and you'd make a fair sort of market value of what product you're going to sell. If the product was so great and was doing such amazing things in the world, then why not charge for it? If it changes people's lives so rapidly, why not charge me for it? But instead, you know, Facebook is worth what Facebook is worth. I think they made $45 billion last year alone in profit. You know, they make about $90 off of every person that they're there. But the reality, I think, coming in the next evolution and the next revolution of social media and other digital, if your product is so awesome, have enough guts to ask me to pay for it. And for families, I believe that parents are my customer. So if parents are my customer, what do parents need today in a digital world that I, as a technology company, can build for them or offer them that helps improve the lives of my parents and their families? So that's a fair exchange. So if a parent says to me, I want a really great chat filter and I want to spend $1.50 a month on that, I'm like, okay, great. If they want a wish list for their kids, I should make that. So this whole notion of digital not being products and not selling things to customers is ridiculous. It's business 101. And there's a really great book by Shoshana Zuboff right now called The Art of Surveillance Capitalism. And I think now anybody that's interested in going into the tech world is make products and then have enough guts to charge for it. And if nobody wants to buy it, whose fault is that? Because if we are going to look at a consumer system and a capitalist system, the very first line on your pro forma is cost of goods sold, right? So what's the cost of this good and how much did I sell? And then you do the math. So it's no different than digital again, like it was in real life. If I opened up a jewelry store and filled it with jewelry, I have an inventory there, I would price the jewelry, and if nobody bought the jewelry, clearly I picked the wrong products, I better go back and try again. And then eventually you get down to the science of what someone's going to buy. And I think what happened in the world of Silicon Valley and having lived there is everybody loves their invention, but nobody asks who's the customer. So, but look at this magical thing I've made, and I'll just bring everybody here, and I'll figure out how to make it a business later. And when it's a business later, then I'll figure out how to monetize. Oh, crap, no one's going to buy it. Oh, I know, I'll just take their data and sell it. But that's not a capitalist system. So whenever I meet with mothers and fathers and parents, I always say advertisers are Facebook's customers, not people. So because that's actually who they're concerned to buy their products. They build products for advertisers. So the advertising industry is Facebook's customer, not me. Now, if I decide to use Facebook and advertise, then I become a customer and I can demand that the products get better. So what advertisers can say to Mark Zuckerberg and to Facebook, make your product better for me because I'm giving you billions of dollars. Humans are secondary in that system. But what we say at Mazoo is parents are our customer first. So I say to my dev team all the time, what product are we giving them that they actually want to buy? And if we've made something that they don't want to buy, then let's find out what they want us to make that they want to buy. Because that's how business is.
Do you think there's a way around this then, Janice? Do you think that there is a way to have an advertising model that provides revenue for the business and for shareholders, but in such a way that doesn't compromise digital well-being?
I think there's an evolution to the advertising model as long as humans decide that to make it so. In some ways, I do think that there, I used a great example between Coke and Pepsi. So if you think about Coke and Pepsi, and you looked at them as two major things, they both made a soda. Now, what Pepsi did, what was really fascinating when you read the story, is they diversified their product offering. And they were the first to really dive into the healthy drink era, you know, the vitamin waters and the different types of bottled water. Like, Pepsi really looked at, well, you know, I'm not necessarily going to win head-to-head with Coke. Coke has got the lockdown on that. But I need to diversify my products so that I can actually make something useful and make this a go and be a healthy second alternative to Coke. But if you look at Coke, they doubled down on soda. And so when you look at their market distribution, they've now, Coke has diversified and they took sort of Pepsi's lead from that. But they really did double down on Coke. Now, if you think about the world of digital and you've got advertising as one section of the pie chart. Now, right now, you've got Facebook where about 90 whatever some odd percentage is all ad revenue. And if you look at the numbers in the digital revenue numbers of ad revenue, Google and Facebook take 75 cents of every dollar. So that leaves 25 cents for the rest of the digital world that wants to use advertising. So if you think about that, that's a really small pie that everybody has to feed off of now because off the hop, Facebook and Google take 75 cents of every dollar. So if you're going into the world of digital and you're building products, think about it from a diversified model. You may have some advertising in there, but don't double down that you're going to be able to get all the ad spend, because if you're going after eyeballs, that's not going to work for you. And so what we say, we have a pie graph in our office here at Mazu, and we have like different pies, and we call ourselves Pepsi. So we're the Pepsi of the world. We're the alternative where people are really tired of Coke. So we're the Pepsi of the world. So we look at it like, what are the different areas of potential revenue streams of where people spend money in digital, and then design your model from that idea. But knowing the model of ad revenue, again, 75 cents of every dollar goes to Facebook and Google. So if you're a small startup and you need to go and design a business model that a venture capitalist is going to ask you about, that's going to be the number one thing they're going to ask you. And that's why a lot of companies don't necessarily raise money right away, because Facebook and Google dominate so much on that marketplace. I think the products that are going to win in the future go back to the business basics of a capitalist model and look at, how do I build a product for a specific customer base that someone wants to pay for? And I think we're moving into a quality over quantity world, where quality is going to matter more to people now, because we've overconsumed on quantity.
So, Janice, where can people find out more about you and about Mazu and connect with you?
And again, any entrepreneur or mom or dad or parent or fellow founder ever wants to email me, please feel free. You can learn about us at mazufamily.com. We are based here in Canada, but we have an audience in the United States, Australia, and the UK, but we're open to expanding. So if you can go to mazufamily.com, you can also download Mazu in the App Store and Google Play to learn a little bit about our platform. And again, any ideas and suggestions to create more digital mindfulness, we're open to hearing those and to also collaborating with any other different companies that has a similar mission.
Well, Janice, it was worth the wait from my perspective to have you on the show. Wish you all the very best with the platform, and it's been a real pleasure having you here.